she's a real postmodern scholar. I think she starts as a champion of what's called genetic criticism. And she had a meeting with McLuhan, which is interesting. She had that in her background. So McLuhan says he wrote her about the French translation of Eric's piece on Joyce and pray that she will still have it. Derek does not have a copy. I'm going to try to get the Ovid and the Five Divisions ready for Ralph Cohen. It's all good warm-up for the old thesis anyway. I guess they're thinking of trying to get his PhD published or do an update of it. So a lot of Eric's studies are helping what Marshall has to do. McLuhan got into Laetrile. It was a popular fringe cancer treatment in the 70s. And he's writing somebody, have found this bit of information about Laetrile. We do have about a pound of the stuff, which might well serve for a trial treatment. He might be writing someone who has cancer. So the great rational McLuhan was into crackpot medicine. Just probing. He was exploring. The woman who was doing the opposite of McLuhan in reference to Hegel and Mallarmé was a family friend. So, a bit difficult there. He's reading his family friend's this book and hoping it's wrong. Okay, here's another one with Eric. So we know it'll have a lot of this rhetorical and grammatical concerns. Okay, he says, have begun to work on the mystery of when Eliot hit upon the five divisions, which he uses in The Wasteland. It obviously took place during the revising of The Wasteland, since it surfaces in Wyndham Lewis and retained thereafter It obviously took place during the revising of The Wasteland, since it surfaces in Wasteland and is retained thereafter in The Hollow Men and in The Four Quartets, those later poems. Looking at the cantos, I see no clear demarcations of the five divisions in the way that Eliot used them. And he's trying to figure out how they got into The Wasteland, because Pound is very much a midwife in the making of The Wasteland, helping Eliot. So he's looking at the cantos to see if they got the five divisions. Did Eliot get it from Pound? But he can't find it. He'll keep probing and would welcome your suggestions. So Walter Ong, who was a student, a Jesuit priest and a student of McLuhan, back in the early 40s at St. Louis, he becomes a very famous semi-McLuhanite. You ever heard of him, Walter Ong? And it's like Innes. People say, well, Innes is more important than McLuhan, or Ong is better than McLuhan. And Ong, being a student, I think McLuhan recommended he do a PhD on Ramus, this guy in the 1500s or so, that moves education into visually biased, say, dialectic, and drops the full trivium and quadrivium. So Walter Ong wrote a thesis, PhD, on Ramus, and that's what I've been mentioning a couple times there, the Ramus roots of Hegel and Mallarmé. What?
No, I just said Mallarmé.
Yeah, Mallarmé. So Walter Ong, McLuhan criticizes him a lot in these letters. He says, reading Walter Ong as a preliminary, now, they're saying, people say Walter Ong was the best student of McLuhan and all that, is what Marshall thought. Reading Walter Ong as a preliminary to working on my own dissertation, so he's going to redo and update his own PhD, I am amazed by his pedestrian writing and his skill in avoiding insights. Very skillful. And he has become the Modern Language Association. You know, that would be the prestigious linguistic educational English teacher stuff.
That's a very good phrase. You are so skilled in avoiding insights.
Yes. He is the new head. Ong is also the new head of the Modern Language Association, so he's very in the middle of the establishment. Then he says, maybe we should send him a copy of your own Wordsworth piece. Then he says, looking at Cicero's De Inventione, page 105, he notes, quote, Cicero says, and that's where rhetoric, he's the god of rhetoric analysis, an argument treated in the same way seems to one group threefold and to another fivefold. So that's the argument between the guys who know about the five divisions and the others who don't and have a three division. And he sees this right in Cicero. An argument treated in the same way seems to one group threefold and to another fivefold. And he says, I enclose pages 109, 103, and 105. By the way, on page 405 of Topica, Cicero says, quote, by concept, I mean what the Greeks call enoia or prolepsis. This is an innate knowledge of anything which has been previously apprehended and needs to be unfolded. So concept, I mean what the Greeks call enoia or prolepsis. This is an innate knowledge of anything which has been previously apprehended and needs to be unfolded. So then he talks about his neighbor who visited the Martello Tower in Dublin that James Joyce lived in, and it's the beginning scene in Ulysses. So when our neighbor was visiting the Martello Tower recently, he talked to a young custodian and bragged of his acquaintance with Marshall and Eric, to which the young guy said, quote, there's been an awful lot of junk written about Joyce, but I have a book coming out from the University of Dallas Press that will end all that. Perhaps you can get a preview of this by direct... Oh, what is this? No, okay, so that's the quote. There's been an awful lot. So the guy who's the expert of the Martello Tower, the guide, says there's been an awful lot of junk written about Joyce, but I have a book coming out from the University of Dallas Press that will end all that. Well, that's curious because McLuhan is involved with the University of Dallas Press. I guess that's what the joke is. Well, no. He's interested in the book. So he says, perhaps, Eric, you can get a preview of this by direct inquiry to the Dallas Press. In fact, they would probably appoint you as a reviewer. Okay, so he's just saying, thought there was something jokey here. So the guy, he has a book coming up from a press that Eric is nearby and could get an early look at. So you notice McLuhan's reading constantly, keeping up on all the developments. So another letter to Eric. Have just read a PhD thesis on medieval science in the work of Bernard Sylvester and Marianus Capella. Would appreciate your scanning the works of Capella. For example, The Wedding of Philology and Mercury, and the works of Sylvester. This is called The Cosmographia of Bernardus Silvestria. So he's saying, check out Sylvester and Capella for evidence of five divisions. Like, you know, the five acts of Shakespeare's plays are a reference to the five divisions. Brian Stock has a book on the same people, which I have yet to read. He says he will bring it around for me to see. Three recent votes in favor of Ovid and Joyce liaison have come from David Staines. He was a former student of McLuhan, and he did a book with Stephanie McLuhan on major interviews and essays of McLuhan in the 50s and 60s. What's that one called? Understanding Me. And it has the interview with Fulford where he, quote, predicts the internet, unquote. So three recent votes in favor of Ovid and Joyce liaison have come from the liaison of Ovid and Joyce have come from David Staines at Harvard, who reports that both Douglas Bush at Harvard and Norrie Fry here in Toronto have both given it the nod. Bush simply said, quote, "Why should Dubliners be the only merely realistic thing that Joyce wrote? Why should Dubliners be the only merely realistic thing that Joyce wrote?" Here's another interesting statement that he writes to Eric. "I'm looking forward to your follow-up on the..." Eric is doing an essay. "I'm looking forward to your follow-up on the Logos." Eric was writing a lot on the Logos, or at least doing papers on it. Then Marshall says, "Surely much of the matter can be put very simply. When literacy and logic took over, the Logos became a mere category without resonance. When literacy and logic took over, the Logos became a mere category without resonance." Did you get that one? What happened? The dog knock you out?
No, I was muting because the dog is barking.
Okay. So did you hear what I said, what I read? No, because of the
not
dog.
The last part. Yes.
Okay. No, it's an important statement. He says, "I'm looking forward to your follow-up," he says to Eric, "on the Logos. Surely much of the matter..." So then he's telling Eric what he's got to say, so to speak. "Surely much of the matter can be put very simply. When literacy and logic took over, or dialectics, the Logos became a mere category without resonance."
The Logos without resonance?
Yes, it became a mere category. In a way, it lost its vibration, like the concept of God did.
Oh.
Became a dead, victim of literacy. Had lost its preliterate resonance. It became a mere category without resonance.
That is interesting. And that, it's McLuhan who's saying that.
Yeah.
But why did the Logos lose the resonance?
Because it went into a visual bias, which was empty. Lost its acoustic resonance that it had before literacy. Is that so hard to understand?
No. No, okay. I got it.
Okay. I thought you weren't saying anything. Okay. Another letter to Eric. "Apropos your paper on Logos and rhetoric, it might be an ideal time to have a look at some of Tertullian's treatises from the point of view of the five divisions. I've just been through Cider Study, which tries to relate Tertullian's treatises to the parts of an oration in vain. The parts of an oration, that would be the parts of a speech or the five parts of rhetoric. Thanks for the word about Entrago's new book. Any chance of sneaking it up here for copying? I'm sure it will be a long time getting into Toronto Library. Buckner has advised us to get a good photocopier, and we're now doing just that. In a day or two, we will have a machine on trial and could copy any book quickly and without cost. On Saturday, I went through nearly all of Cicero and Quintilian and was much impressed by the amount of repetition." That's all on that one. Okay. Dear Eric, another letter. The enclosed sheet from Heidegger will be familiar to you. He spends his 120 pages trying to translate the two acoustic sentences of the Anaximander into literate prose, which he does by multi-level exegesis. It suddenly occurs to me that the incredible windbagging of the Germans, since Kant at least, may have been prompted by this inner conflict between the oral and written forms of awareness. As soon as one grasps the nature of this conflict, most of the German meditations appear futile and banal, but also incredibly pompous. That sound familiar to you? In your reading of German?
No.
What? No?
No. Maybe.
Let me read that again. The enclosed sheet from Heidegger will be
I'm
familiar
tired,
to you.
But, yes.
All right. He spends 120... Heidegger spends 120 pages trying to translate the two acoustic sentences of Anaximander into literate prose, translate the ear into eye, which he does by multi-level exegesis. It suddenly occurs to me that the incredible windbagging of the Germans, so they'd be an oral culture, since Kant at least, may have been prompted by this inner conflict between the oral and written forms of awareness. Germans having a heavy oral pattern, encountering the written form, they're left in the interval windbagging. As soon as one grasps the nature of this conflict, most of their meditations appear futile and banal, but also incredibly pompous. Then he says,
yes, until now, the German language doesn't have like a fixed grammar and syntax. They're always changing the rules. Like when I learned German, there was some orthography and some rules, and then they changed them. So it's
that's an oral culture. They
it's like they haven't arrived to a fixed.
They can't get
grammar and orthography.
What? Autography?
Or the orthography and the loss of the grammar.
Right. They are finding it hard to be solidly visual. So they're making visual rules, but it's always subject to the oral drift or the oral subtleties of change.
Yes, and
so this inner conflict between the oral and written
forms
of awareness.
I always wonder why was this that they're always changing?
Right. Well, like, that would be this inner conflict. It's interesting. You'll never look at a German different. You'll never look at the German the same again. You'll look at them having this inner conflict between the oral preference and the contrasting written form awareness. They can't settle.
Yes, and it's funny because the Gutenberg Galaxy was born here in Germany.
That's right, yeah. So he says, as soon as one grasps the nature of this conflict, most of their meditations appear futile and banal, but also incredibly pompous. Then he mentions Jane Austen in her book Mansfield Park. He says, in Mansfield Park by Jane Austen, there are two digressions so far, and he's about two-thirds way through the book. One concerns amateur theatricals, in which everybody discovers who he is by pretending to be somebody else. And the second digression is a game of whist, which acts as a double plot also. So he's still going through the canon, commenting on things, and while publicly he's talking on a whole other different level. Or it's the same awareness of process in both cases. His private literary interest and his collective management of the global theater. One concerns amateur theatricals in which everybody discovers who he is by pretending to be somebody else. And the second one is a game of whist, which acts as a double plot also. I don't recall playing whist any time, so I've heard the name, but I don't know what you do. You ever play whist?
No.
Okay.
But it's amazing the amount of topics we've been through.
Yes, that's what I'm trying to get across.
Into everything.
That's right. Thinking about everything.
Anytime. For no reason at all.
Yes. Zappa made music with no reason at all. McLuhan made thoughts for no reason at all.
Anytime, anywhere, for no reason.
Yeah, like he's making patterns for no reason at all. Or no reason anybody else finds useful.
Just like he could not stop. He was just full time.
Yeah, yeah.
On duty.
Yeah, yeah. Okay. Okay, so here's another letter to Eric. So Kathy Hutchin, who did City's Classroom, was one of the contributors. He says, Kathy's here working along on the subject of Canada, the borderline case. That's a very interesting essay or talk by McLuhan, which, you know, seems to be totally his stuff. But here's this woman, Kathy, is working or helping him in some way and composed that essay. It's an important statement. In the mid-70s. Then he says, meantime, I have pieced together the Joyce Ovid thing from a rhetorical point of view and have sent a copy to Ralph Cohen and one to Tom Staley. Ralph wants the piece for New Literary History, that's a journal, if it is usable at all. And Tom Staley is merely being kidded a little more. Tom Staley was one of the major guys in the James Joyce Quarterly. And Tom Staley is merely being kidded a little more. So he's teasing the Joycean. You will see that... No. Can't read that. Okay, maybe this one. He says to Eric, Your scholarly endeavors are quite impressive. Your thoughts about a little collection of Arthur Miller type essays is great. Arthur Miller is the guy who did the famous play Death of a Salesman, and then wrote an essay on the effect of TV on Broadway. I think that's what it was. And McLuhan always liked that essay. So Eric is suggesting, why don't we do a series of Arthur Miller-type essays? Here's an interesting point. He says... apropos your own job future, he says this to Eric, you should keep in mind that the man with an almost PhD, that's in quotes, the man with an almost PhD can get a job much more easily than the PhD in the present market. It means they can hire you for less, and this has become a major concern. The highly qualified person remains jobless. So best not to finish your PhD. So they will give you a job, they'll pay you less, but you get a job. If you're highly qualified, they can't afford to pay that. So listen to this one. Another one to Eric. Wanted you to have this sample of the fish book, that Stanley Fish I mentioned earlier, which shows amazing variations on the cognitive agent theme from a Platonic angle. The cognitive agent theme. Does it not relate directly to the Phoenix Playhouse? That's in Finnegan's Wake. The affective fallacy, gets a chapter in Wellick and Warren's Theory of Literature, a book called Theory of Literature. Fish, Stanley Fish, pushes the whole thing into the audience's lap without really knowing what to do. However, his work will be very useful to us. Have found entrogal entrancing, i.e. his Book of Mind and Body. Entrogal is a guy that McLuhan quoted who did an essay or a book called The Therapy of the Word in Ancient Times or something. The Therapy of the Word. Looks sort of like the Massage of the Word. Then he did a new book here, Mind and Body. Entralgo, E-N-T-R-A-L-G-O. You fall asleep?
No.
Okay.
No, some of these things are quite new.
Right.
I haven't seen in the book.
So he said...
A lot of topics.
Yeah. He says, I think the reason that all of this got buried, again, talking about the history of rhetoric and decorum and all that. I think the reasons that all of this got buried relates to the kind of cultural smog which was generated by the Greeks apropos their new visual bias. It comes out quite well, I think, in Entrago's Mind and Body, which is a godsend for Bob Logan and me in our work on the effects of the alphabet. Once the five divisions got involved in the human anatomy, coherence collapsed. Once the five divisions of rhetoric got involved in the human anatomy, coherence collapsed. I'm not sure how the five divisions map in human anatomy.
And why would that make coherence collapse?
It caused fragmentation. It's like the logos losing its resonance. You know, the eye is neutral. You start extending the eye, you flatten space. You can get a deadness. But it's a novelty. So people like it, so the people don't realize the disadvantages of it.
I always thought these five points of rhetoric were like an attempt to make things even more coherent and rational.
I know.
Like the disposition is the order.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Had you heard of the five divisions before?
Yeah, because of you.
Oh, okay, but not in your own education. Not in your own education.
Well, maybe yes, but not as it was not right. A big deal. I mean, you hear about the quadrivium and the trivium, but it's like that was in the Middle Ages, and that's it.
So once the five divisions got involved in the human anatomy, that to me is like categories, fragmented specialist categories that got layered over the human anatomy, then something about body awareness collapsed, coherence collapsed. He says to Eric, He says, just back from Harvard, where I had the impression that the grad students are very much mothered as compared with most places. They're pampered. Things went quite well. I met the great John Kelleher, ultimate expert on all Irish names, and he told me at once that Flynn, who's a name in the Sisters, the story called The Sisters, means red. That's pure gold. It ties in perfectly with the creation myth of Ovid's Book One and the decline from the Age of Gold. I don't know how the gold and the red relate. What?
I don't understand what he's saying. Why?
Why is the red gold?
Okay.
What happened? What?
Nothing.
Okay. All right. He says, one of the words which we omitted, he's writing to Eric, one of the words which we omitted from our discussions about center margin, that's visual space, and dispositio is the word Gnostic, N-O-S-T-I-C. He might mean Gnostic, G-N-O-S-T, I'm not sure. One of the words which we omitted from our discussions is the word Gnostic. It relates also very much to archetypes and that brand of aestheticism. It relates also very much to archetypes and that brand of aestheticism. So then he addresses Eric's daughter, Emily. And he says to Eric, try not to have Emily exposed to hours and hours of TV. It is a vile drug which permeates the nervous system, especially in the young. The vile drug. There we were talking earlier about what's a drug. Way back there, and TV is a vile drug. Okay. He says to Eric, I enclose a copy of pages from Bokinski, a small book which I hope you can find at the University of Dallas. Haven't had much time with it myself. So then he's talking about this Professor Kelleher. Yesterday, they arrived from Professor Kelleher an off-print from his study of the names in the dead. Also enclosed. I am a bit uncertain as to how to approach him on the Ovid subject. I think I shall limit myself to the Flynn name and its relation to the first book of Ovid and the fall from the Age of Gold. I got to check, go back a bit for a second here. Kelleher. Yeah, I met the great John Kelleher in Harvard. still looking. Okay, here's another letter to Eric. Your letter and enclosures on Logos, etc., most interesting and valuable. Bob Logan popped in with a manuscript on the subject of zero, which is to be part of our small book on the alphabet and science, past and present. It reminded me to ask you about that book by Adams concerning 19th century art and the theme of nothing, or zero, or interval, or some such. Can you recall the book? I have forgotten both the title and the author at the moment. He was the son of Professor G.L. Crapp of Yale, who changed his name to Adams or something like that. Sorry, that's all we have there. Weak contribution there. Oh, here's a long letter to Eric. This should have something. He says, yesterday Bob Logan came up with a dandy while we were working on Hans Selye's stress tetrad. He used Selye early in the 50s for his own articles. He pointed out, Logan pointed out that the retrieval in stress is old diseases, i.e. antibodies. And I suddenly realized that that is the structural form of retrieval in all the tetrads. For example, the motor car retrieving the knights in shining armor. Bob and I have been making considerable headway on our short study of the effects of the alphabet on science, past and present. I think I mentioned that the key to Parmenides, and be sure to get Philip Wheelwright's book, The Pre-Socratics. He has all the text plus good commentary. Meanwhile, the key to Parmenides is his unconscious acceptance of the hidden ground of the new visual space, which at once gave him the technique of matching. Visual space being static, his entire metaphysic follows, i.e. no place for any sort of change except quantitative. Can I hear that again? Logan pointed out that the retrieval in stress is old diseases. So
I really don't know who is that Parmenides.
He's the founder of logic, I think. You know, in Ionia, 700 BC, something like that.
Oh.
He's part of the visual space dupes. Let's see if we look up Parmenides, what we get. The single known work of Parmenides is a poem, On Nature, which has survived only in fragmentary form. In this poem, Parmenides describes two views of reality. In a part of the poem called The Way of Truth, he explains how reality, coined as what is one, change is impossible, and existence is timeless, uniform, necessary, and unchanging. In The Way of Opinion, so one's the way of truth, one's the way of opinion, explains the world of appearances in which one's sensory faculties lead to conceptions which are false and deceitful.
Mm.
That's LaRouche's view. The world of appearances in which one's sensory faculties lead to conceptions which are false and deceitful. Let's see, do they say something, anything about logic? Nope. Nothing more. It doesn't look like. I wonder who I'm thinking of. The founder of logic. Don't know.
Oh, but he's also in the School of Athens by Raphael.
He is? He's
yeah.
in the School of Athens, yeah. Okay, so you retrieve the old diseases. He pointed out that the retrieval in stress is old diseases, i.e. antibodies. And I suddenly realized that that is the structural form of retrieval in all the tetrads. For example, the motor car retrieving the knights in shining armor. Bob and I have been making considerable headway on our short study of the effects of the alphabet on science, past and present. I think I mentioned that the key to Parmenides... He doesn't finish that sentence. He says...
the key to Parmenides is...
No, he does. Sorry.
Fill in the blank. Fill in the blank.
Yeah. Yeah, that's participatory perception, getting the reader involved. I think I mentioned that the key to Parmenides is his unconscious acceptance of the hidden ground of the new visual space, which at once gave him the technique of matching. Visual space being static, his entire metaphysic follows, i.e. no place for any sort of change except quantitative.
Ooh.
Okay, look at this one. An important book for you is E.D. Hirsch's Validity Interpretation. No, Validity in Interpretation. It is a complete account of how the new criticism relates to linguistics and hermeneutics. That's what he's trying to find out about. Have not been completely through it. The Palmer hermeneutics is invaluable, too, in cluing me in on all sorts of intellectual genealogy. I enclose a sheet of Kathy's on the five divisions. She points out that a detective story simply uses the five divisions in reverse order. Let me mention Jane Austen's Persuasion, her last novel. I have been told that nobody has commented on the title as having any significance. However, from the very first, she is concerned with people being moved. And he quotes something from the novel. Her own spirits improve by change of place and subject, by being moved 3 miles from Kellynch. Her own spirits improve by change of place and subject, by being moved 3 miles from Kellynch. So this person needs to be moved. That could be a kind of depressed in the Trump era. Can't find anything exciting. Nothing to move them. Okay, we're going to end in 15 minutes. Okay, here's one. Because Terry is a twin of Mary, Terry's doing a film, or maybe at first a book, but a film. It's called The Twin Study on Twins. Marshall says to Terry, I sent you a snippet from Ornstein. The entire book could be used in any twin study since it shows that we are twins within ourselves. Warren Brody mentioned the other day that one of his twins died at birth, but the survivor has behaved like a twin ever since, i.e. they had been together for 9 months, and the survivor feels the presence of the other. So I should tell Bill, what do you think? You ready to take a break? Hey, fall asleep? I think you did. Your private messaging bill's not working. We're going to end this hour. Can't get a message to you, though. So, you are not... Oh, wait a minute. My connection's okay. I see you've been muted. To refresh here. Waiting for it to connect. A lot of people have been muted. So, Sean, sorry, you've been muted. 973 has been muted, and Roxy's been muted, right?
Yeah. Yes.
All right, good. Anything you want to say?
No, it's okay.
Hi, Bob. It's Sonia. It's been really good.
How you doing,
good.
Sean? You're learning a lot, eh?
Yes. Yes. I just have like some background noise there, so I can't comment all the time.
What did you say? Someone's there?
I said, yeah, just background noise, so I can't comment on all the time, but such good content.
Well, it's an education for someone. I mean, it's like, you know, when you're in class, you hear ideas, words pass through you. You get it in fragments. That's an education. So we're doing the education here. Mentioning
yeah,
all
the
different. Yeah. So,
thank you.
Yeah. I think here's a continuation of the previous article. Just a second, I'll go back to this. We were talking about the moving of the body. Yeah. So, this, her own spirits improved by change of place and subject, by being moved 3 miles from Kilinch. Everybody, at the end of the quote, and then McLuhan says, everybody in the book is moved about continually until both physically and psychically they have nothing. Have a look at it for the principle of decorum and also the five divisions. I seem to detect them everywhere. I haven't read Mansfield Park or Emma, but I've been told that Persuasion is a completely maverick novel. Your essay on logos and formal causality I haven't had time to digest, but I'm really looking forward to getting down to the thesis itself. I include some sheets from Wyndham Lewis's criticism. There's a new selection from it called Enemy Salvos. I can see that he has found the inside-outside or S.O. theme in Henry James and Virginia Woolf. I think that might mean going outside. I'm not sure. I can see that he has found the inside outside or S.O. S.O. theme in Henry James and Virginia Woolf. I know that Nelson Thal found a lot of going outside to be alone, going inside to be social. Maybe that's what he means by the inside slash outside. In Henry James and Virginia Woolf. Scott Taylor, who's on one of the last sessions on our McLuhan Centenary, whatever it was called, Maui, something on Maui. Forget what we called it. Scott Taylor is on twice, and he has an interesting talk with Ion. So McLuhan says here, Scott Taylor tells me that the inside-outside thing is pervasive in William James's Principles of Psychology, also. So, what was it, Maui? What did we call ourselves? McLuhan on Maui, right. Scott Taylor.
Were we?
Yeah. Yeah, and so Scott Taylor, he was a student friend of McLuhan's 40 years ago, 74, 75, 76, and this is 40 years later. So, Marshall mentions him speaking about William James, I guess Henry James's brother. Hey, Bill, did you get the message? I'll panic button him.
Dun, dun, dun.
Oh, he's fixed this thing here. Yeah, he says, okay. All right, he got the message. All right. Okay, we're going to try to make this last 10 minutes cram-packed with insights.
One more insight, please.
Okay. I like that interesting comment that Lewis knew the inside-outside theme.
Mm-hmm. Do you have any correspondence or exchanges of Lewis and McLuhan?
Yes. Yes, we do. There was a good little chunk of it. Well, this is an obscure statement, but I'll just say it. Referring to the sisters. Why are the sisters, are they in the Dubliners or in the Portrait of the Artist? No, not the Portrait of the Artist. What's the other thing? Has to be the Dubliners. I'm just going to check that. Because they're trying to match up, yeah, Dubliners, the sisters, the first story in Dubliners. So they're trying to, you know, figure out this five pattern and the parallel between Ovid and James Joyce. So he says, the Waltzel essay discovers the sisters as fates, F-A-T-S, F-A-T-E-S. Before that, he says, I enclose a page from Fritz Wilhelmsen's book, which seems to me to relate directly to the sisters. Study it and consider the boy as figure against the sisters as ground. The Waltzel essay discovers the sisters as fates, capital F-A-T-E-S. And Kathy reminds that Book 9 has an oration on fate versus fatalism by Jove. And there's more on the theme in Book 15 when Ovid describes his fate versus Augustus's, Caesar's fate. Ovid discussed his fate versus Augustus' fate. McLuhan says, Eric, meantime, I'm not too happy about the proposed jacket for the high school book or City is Classroom, but I certainly have no intention of imposing my preferences where those of students and teachers are also involved. Isn't that nice? I am not too happy about the proposed jacket for the book, but I certainly have no intention of imposing my preferences where those of students and teachers are also involved.
For what book?
The City is Classroom, 1977.
Uh-huh.
Exercises for Pattern Recognition for the High Schooler.
And what are these exercises?
Different experiments and questions you ask about each medium. It's a whole, like, you have to do stuff like it's a high school textbook with things you do. It doesn't mean physical exercise. It means mental exercises, like taking a magazine and cutting all the ads out of the magazine. And what do the articles that are left there look like? Which is flashier, the articles or the ads? I remember that one.
Yeah.
Many other experiments. So here's something. Now, this is a personal statement. You don't get that often. The hemispheres, you know, the hemispheres of the brain. He says, the hemispheres thing has become an obsession with me simply because it is so refreshing to switch strategies. There are no concepts involved in the hemispheres, only medical empirical data. So he's saying that his emphasis on the hemispheres rather than sensory spaces was a change in his strategy of formal causality, of relating to the audience, of getting trying to get attention to media studies. The hemispheres thing has become an obsession with me simply because it's so refreshing to switch strategies. There are no concepts involved in the hemispheres, only medical empirical data.
That's very interesting.
Yeah. He's talking about strategies, Nippian. What'd you say?
Who has, as a thinker, I don't think anybody thought before him, oh, I have to address their left hemisphere or their right hemisphere. Or... That's really interesting.
Okay, so then another letter to Eric. I know there's Lefebvre. He's the Catholic renegade, right? Monsieur Father Lefebvre. He's a rogue. He left the Vatican or something. Accuses the Vatican of being taken over by bad guys. So. I guess Eric or somebody sent him a sermon by Lefebvre. Bakun says the Lefebvre sermon is interesting. The little matter about the mason in the woodpile is really something. The little matter about the mason, the Freemason in the woodpile is really something. What do you think of that? Conspiracy theories.
Yeah.
Then he says, last night, working on Ezra Pound's Women of Trachis and the theme of Heracles. Or Hercules, spelled Heracles. I think I found the missing link between Ovid and Dubliners. See, they're still working on it. Trying to figure out how to match the 15 stories of Ovid up with the 15 stories of Joyce's Dubliners. He says, remember Woodward's essays on Sophocles? One of them concerns the varying concepts of the heroic among the Greeks. Varying concepts of the heroic, changing. There was a divergence between the center without margin hero, that would be the acoustic hero, and the center with margin fragmented, center with margins fragmented hero. Plainly, Ulysses, the wily and devious, is very fragmented. Joyce had intended at one time to call Dubliners, the book, Ulysses at Dublin. This would explain Dublin as the center of paralysis. That's a quote from one of Joyce's stories. And the Dubliners as all fragmented people. Have a look at Woodward's collection of essays on Sophocles. The fragmented angle also throws much light on Bloom, who is Flaubert's Bouvard and Pécuchet. That's a novel by Flaubert. I think this is it, he says, the link.
If I get hurt.
There, finished, right on time.
Perfect.
That would be okay.
That was an amazing exploration.
Thank you. We can talk
Thank
in
you
a
both.
Few minutes.
There'd be nothing
Thank you.
To fix.
Thank you for showing up. Thank you for
nothing
being formal causality.
To find transfer.
Thank you
the
for addressing our both hemispheres of the brain.
Nothing to hide, forget, or figure out. Nothing to conceal, or carry, or break, wear down, wear out, or bury. Sweetheart.